Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
Continue our study of the Bible book by book with an emphasis on the fact that the Bible is one book, and though composed of 66 books, but books that are so related and so connected that they form the central theme of God's plan for saving man through the central personality of all the Bible, Jesus the Christ. Now, we've looked at the book of Genesis and also the book of Exodus. The first five books of the Old Testament are referred to as the Pentateuch. Pentateuch referring to five. These are the books of Moses. And it's my intent tonight that we survey the book of Leviticus and also the book of Numbers. I believe that we will have adequate time in a reasonable session to look at both of these. The book of Leviticus is a book of some 26 chapters and is sometimes called the book of the priest. And I think you can see that it gets its name from the tribe, the priestly tribe of Levi. And it was this priestly tribe that was given this priestly code. And when the book of Leviticus was written, the people were still at Mount Sinai, where God had called Moses up into the mountain to receive the law of Moses. And actually, Leviticus is a continuation of the book of Exodus, because so much of the book of Exodus does involve the giving of various civil and religious laws for the people. And then the laws here in Leviticus become a little bit more specific. And whereas they were of interest and were of concern to the entire nation, they were laws that would primarily concern the priesthood, which would come, as I said, from the tribe of Levi. We have to keep in mind the nature of the law of Moses. Because it was their civil law, it was ceremonial in nature, it was moral, it was religious, it was in even the details of their sanitary habits, their dietary habits, their social habits. It governed all of the totality of their life. And it was exclusively for the Israelite nation, this nation that came through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 sons of Jacob. And this nation is, of course, the messianic nation, because it was through that nation that the Messiah was to come. And everything about the book of Leviticus, even though it governed the priesthood of Levi, that would be the priesthood of the Israelites, it pointed toward the priesthood of Jesus Christ. Now, we do not turn to the book of Levi to learn about how we are to serve God today. But, as I said, this was for Israel, but the book of Levi emphasizes one word more than any other. Some 87 to maybe 90 different times, the word holy is found in the book of Levi. And the word holy means something that is sanctified, something that is set apart, something that has a special and unique relationship here to God. And the book of Levi emphasizes that God is holy. And even though man is sinful, God has provided certain ceremonies and rituals whereby the people of Israel might approach God in their worship. And these were part of the laws by which they were to be governed to keep them a holy nation, a separate and distinct nation, and to keep them apart from all of the other nations. And it was a law that would provide for the Israelites a religious heritage, and it was a law that would present types and pre-pictures of the coming dispensation of Jesus Christ. The old law is referred to in the book of Hebrews as being shadows. And the things of the priesthood were signs, and they were, as I speak of it often, arrows pointing to the coming of Christ. There were a number of sacrificial systems that characterized the Jewish worship. And in the book of Leviticus, we read of their burnt offerings and their meal offerings and their meat offerings. We read about their peace offerings and their sin offerings and their trespass offerings. And we'll not take time to study the significance and the distinction and the uniqueness of each of these sacrifices, but they all had a place. And they all accomplished a certain specific purpose. And many of them, though not all, many of them involved animal sacrifices and the shedding of animal blood, which was never designed and never intended to be the way that God would ultimately atone for the sins of man. But the blood of the sacrifices under the old law and by the Levitical priesthood pointed to that ultimate perfect sacrifice of the Son of God. We even read here in the book of Leviticus about the what is called the clean and the unclean animals. We read of certain dress that the priesthood was to wear. We read of vows and promises and warnings and seasons and meats and drinks and all of the many rituals and ceremonies. And it becomes rather complicated as you read in the book of Leviticus to keep it all straight. And I don't profess to have it all straight, even though I've read it many times. But you read about the blessings that were to come, and you read about the feast days that they were to keep, and all of the various observances in which the people of Israel would be led by these priests of the tribe of Levi. Now, keep in mind, the book is primarily about the priesthood. There is very little historical information in the book of Levi, or Leviticus. But there was one very significant historical event that teaches us a tremendous lesson, somewhat similar to the point of authority that I was bringing out this morning. It had to do with two priests named Nadab and Abihu, and it was a part of their work as priests to take fire from a certain designated place and to utilize that fire in offerings unto God. Well, Nadab and Abihu took what Leviticus 10 refers to as strange fire. That is, they secured fire. And they secured it from a place that was not authorized or designated by God for it to be secured. And when they got that fire and went to use that fire, why the Lord caused that fire to come out upon them and devour them, and it told in Leviticus chapter 10, it's because they did that which the Lord commanded not. They simply presumptuously took it upon themselves. Well, we might reason, fire is fire. What difference does it make? Well, the difference that it made was God said do it this way, and they decided to do it some other way. And God showed His displeasure with man in doing things that are unauthorized, and these two priests lost their lives because of it. But other than that, there's not really a whole lot of historical information to be found in the book of Leviticus. Now keep in mind, and this is where we tie things together and tie these books together. Prior to the time of the Israelites coming out of Egyptian bondage and coming to Mount Sinai, the fathers of the families served as the link between God and these families. They served as the priests. The fathers were as the priests. It was somewhat of a family religion. The patriarchs were the leaders of their various families, like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and so on. And it was all a family-oriented system. But now we're talking about not a family system, but a national system. One that governed the entire nation. And the fathers of families would no longer be that intermediary between God and the family, but there was now this special priesthood class. And in this, there was certain similarities between that and New Testament Christianity, but a very distinct difference. There is no special priesthood class in Christianity, because all Christians are priests. But under the old Mosaic law, there were these special priests and even a special high priest. And it was from certain families that these priests were to serve and the various things that they were to do. In fact, the high priesthood Whereas the priesthood generally would come from the tribe of, or would always come from the tribe of Levi, the high priesthood always was to come from the family of Aaron. And Aaron, the brother of Moses, he was the first high priest. And that's the reason of the importance of the genealogies that you read so often in the Bible. Because the genealogies determine who was in line to become the next priest and who was in line to become the next high priest. And this is the way God organized it, and He arranged a system that would perpetuate it. And this high priesthood that would come from the family of Aaron, why, it was and was a pre-shadow and a type of the high priesthood of Jesus Christ. And when you come to the book of Hebrews, why, it is shown that the priesthood of Christ was not like the priesthood of the people of Aaron, but was like the priesthood of Melchizedek, which in the book of Hebrews shows was a superior priesthood to that of Aaron, showing that the priesthood of Christ was superior to the priesthood that existed under the old Mosaic law. So all of these things had a purpose. These things were not simply to govern Israel. Keep in mind, there is this central goal and theme throughout the Bible of pointing to Christ and the mission of Christ. And whereas all of these things that took place had their individual and immediate significance, they all were joined together because of the ultimate significance of all of these things. And God so designed it that way, and that's one of the reasons that we can know, seeing how these patterns just fit so perfectly, that God overruled and God foresaw and God answered these things to make them fit just exactly that way that no human being could possibly have ever concocted or executed without God's overseeing and overriding power in governing it all. And so it was in the book of Leviticus we read about these people that were to serve in this religious capacity for the people of Israel. And this brings us then to the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers is a book of some 36 chapters. And the book of Numbers is that book that tells us so much of what we know about the wanderings of the people of Israel in the wilderness. And as the Bible student is aware, those wanderings covered from the time of leaving Egypt to the time of crossing the Jordan into the Promised Land, a period of some 40 years. And that's all brought out here in the book of Numbers. Now, the book of Numbers, it gets its name from the numbering of the people. There were two specific taking of census of the people. One was the second year after they came out of Egypt, and the other was 38 years later as they were about to enter into the Promised Land. And so it is from that the book of Numbers is given its name. Always keep in mind, when you talk about Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, or any other, God has not named these books. These are names that men have designated, and with a great deal of wisdom and expediency in identifying them. But the names themselves are not inspired. But we can see why these books are named as they were. Genesis, talking about the beginnings. Exodus, talking about the coming out. Leviticus, having to do with the Levitical priesthood. Numbers, because of the census that was taken on two separate occasions of the people of Israel. And the central figure of the book of Numbers was the man Moses. And Moses wrote the Pentateuch. He wrote the first five books. And Moses gives an account of the journeys and an account of the experiences that the people of Israel had during their some 40 years from Egypt and into Sinai and into the wilderness and ultimately to the eastern bank of the river Jordan. Actually, the book of Numbers, though it gets its name from these two times of census of the people, is more a book of history than it is a book of numbering, because it tells the history of these wanderings. And really, the greater portion of the book of Numbers deals with the last year of their wanderings. Some 26 chapters give historical events after leaving Sinai, and 17 of those 26 chapters deal with the last year of their wandering. And so we can see that all of the intervening years, was there's much information there of events that didn't that took place that we do not have record of them, but we have enough record to know of the things that took place. For instance, it's in the book of Numbers that we find out how God fed the people with manna and with a quail. It's in the book of Numbers that we find Miriam, Moses' sister, being stricken with leprosy. It's in the book of Numbers that we read about a conspiracy among some to overthrow the authority of Moses, led by a man named Korah, K-O-R-A-H, and of his rebellion and his destruction. It was in the book of Numbers where Moses struck the rock to provide the people with water. It's in the book of Numbers later on Moses struck the rock again when he was supposed to speak to the rock and took certain credit to himself for bringing water to the people, and because of his arrogance and of his pride and of his assuming a power that was not his and portraying himself as something that he was not, he personally was not allowed to enter into the land of Canaan. It's in the book of Numbers that we read of that very dramatic instance that took place from Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh Barnea is where the Israelites, after they left Sinai, they went toward Canaan, came to that place, and that's where Moses selected 12 spies to go into the land and to spy out the land. And they came back and gave the report, and that's where all of the spies said, yes, the land is just like God said. It's a land that flows with milk and honey. But 10 of them were faithless. 10 of them were fearful. 10 of them said, we can't take it. 10 of them exaggerated the obstacles. They said, why, they're filled with giants over there. We're just like grasshoppers. And all of that exaggeration, and they melted the hearts of the people. And that was the situation where Joshua and Caleb rose in stature, because they tried to inspire the people to go on and do what God said. We're able to take it. God has promised us this land. But of course, you remember, in spite of their courage and in spite of their leadership, the people listened to the ten, and as a result, they had to wander in the wilderness, and they wandered in the wilderness 1 year for each day that the spies were gone on their spy mission. And so was their punishment. And so we have in the book of Numbers the movements of the people of Israel during these years and certain events that took place in the wilderness. The book of Numbers, after the census, begins and shows the great preparation for the march, the order of the march, how the people were to be arranged around the tabernacle, and it tells about some more of the intricate services of the Levites, and how they were guided by a cloud in the day and a pillar of fire by night. And when the cloud would move or the pillar of fire, they were to move, and when that did not move and stayed at a space, why, they were to stay at that space and at that place that long. What is just over and over again found in the book of Numbers, the Israelites murmuring and complaining against Moses and against God and what God was doing for them. Now, doubtless it was a period of great hardship. Particularly does this murmuring and complaining follow after they faithlessly decided to listen to the ten spies. And whenever anything would come up, why, they would murmur and they would complain to Moses, and Moses would take it to God. In fact, things got so bad one time, God decided, Moses, I'm just going to destroy all those people and start all over with you. That's how provoked God got with them. And Moses, he persuaded God not to do that. He said, your enemies, the enemies of Israel, and the enemies of the true and living God would say, you promised something you couldn't fulfill. And so Moses talked God out of it, so to speak, of destroying these people. But these complaints, they were so critical, and they were so habitual, and their murmurings were so antagonistic to everything that Moses was trying to do on behalf of the people. I don't see how Moses listened to those mouthing Jews for 40 years and didn't lose his sanity. I believe I'd have struck something more than the rock long before he did. But he just listened to that, and he pled with them, and he worked with them. Indeed, what a great and marvelous leader Moses proved to be. And at the same time, there were those, even in his own family, Aaron and Miriam, who came to him and said, "Now you're just taking too much on yourself. You ought not have all this authority. We have as much authority as you do." And they challenged Moses' authority. And that's when Miriam had leprosy. And then some challenged the priesthood of Aaron. And Moses had to have a contest with Aaron's rod to show that Aaron and his family were God's chosen ones. And so all of these different things that took place during their period of wanderings was a most difficult time for Moses. But we see some great and marvelous characters come to the forefront in the book of Numbers, particularly at the time of Joshua and Caleb. But now, after all of this wandering, they come back to the place of Kadesh Barnea, where they had once refused to enter the land. Oh, by the way, I do have to bring this out. Let's go back a little bit. I hope I don't confuse you by getting my story not in order here. They left Sinai and they came to Kadesh Barnea, and Moses sent out the 12 spies. The spies came back with the good report of the land, but said, "We can't take it," and the people listened to the 10. And then after it was told them, "All right, you're going to wander in the wilderness 1 year, for every day the spies were gone," they said, "Uh-oh, we've made a mistake. We'll go ahead and take it anyway." And they tried to go ahead and take it anyway. And they were soundly defeated in their attempt. You see, they're like just a lot of times, we do things and here's the punishment. And they say, "Well, the punishment's too heavy. We'll just go ahead anyway." But they couldn't do God that way. They couldn't second guess God and get away with it. And so they had to wander in the wilderness because of their lack of faith. Now, it's a very significant thing, too. As they were wandering in the wilderness, a new generation was born and came to the forefront. In fact, all of those that came out of Egypt from 20 years old and upward, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb, they all died, they all perished in the wilderness. And they were not allowed to enter into the promised land. It was a new generation altogether that finally went into the promised land. But as I said, the book of Numbers emphasizes quite a lot of the events of the last year. And the time that Moses made the mistake about bringing forth water from the rock, we read about the death of Aaron. And that's a highly significant thing because you have to keep in mind, Aaron was Moses' brother. Aaron had been Moses' mouthpiece. It was Aaron's rod that Moses had used so much, beginning with the holding it out over the Red Sea, and the rod that budded to show that God was behind Aaron rather than others who were rebelling against his authority. And it was Aaron that became the first high priest. And so with the death of Aaron, a significant character in the early history of this nation passes from the scene. We also see another very interesting event that took place in this last year of their wanderings, and that was the instance of the fiery serpents and the brazen serpent on the pole. And that all resulted because of their murmuring. They kept complaining against Moses and God, and God sent these fiery serpents among them, that when they were bitten, they died. And they cried out unto Moses, "Now help us. We're in a bad shape. We brought too much on ourselves. Help us." And God told Moses to put this brass serpent on a pole, and those that would behold that brass serpent, though they were bitten, they would survive. And Jesus used that historical event later on to talk about himself, how that as they look to the brass serpent, we must look to the Christ that's raised on the cross. And so that event took place and is recorded for us also in the book of Numbers. And then as they begin to come up on the eastern side of the Jordan River, they run into some heathen peoples here who were the Amorites and some of the Canaanites and under the king of Og and some of the others. And the Israelites soundly, thoroughly, easily crushed and defeated all operations against them. Their military conquest was getting into high gear as they came about to enter into the promised land. In the book of Numbers, we have listed for us at least 42 specific localities where Israel came and camped. Now, we don't know how long they would encamp in these places. 40 years, 42 places. It averaged about a year at a time, wouldn't it? But now, whether they stayed at a year at all these places or not, we wouldn't suggest that. But now, as I said, during these 40 years, a whole new generation came on the scene. And this had some pluses in that they didn't complain so much, and they had fresh blood in the leadership and so forth, but it also had some negatives, because so many of those that finally did enter into the land of Canaan had not seen the events that took place at the Red Sea. They had not seen the plagues that brought them out of Egypt. They had not seen the lightning and the thunder when Moses went into Mount Sinai to receive the law. They had been taught that, but they were not eyewitnesses. So many of them were not eyewitnesses of these things. Therefore, there was not, in many times, this attachment and this loyalty to God that you would hope would be existent in the nation of Israel through whom the Messiah was to come. Possibly, and we'll conclude with these next two or three comments, possibly, yea, probably, the most difficult thing to understand about Israel, as is recorded for us in Numbers, is, as you might well guess, their constant complaint against God. They would never be satisfied. God would provide for them. It looked like that would only satisfy them for a little while. Then they would begin to murmur again, "We don't have this. We don't have that. We have to do this. Why do we have to do that? Why are you commanding this? Moses, you're too hard on us." And on it went for 4 decades. And as I said, Moses had to listen to all of that. And Moses himself was not able to enter into the promised land. And the book of Numbers closes with God taking Moses up on Mount Nebo. Now, Nebo is a mount peak in the mountain range of Pisgah. So in the Bible, you'll read how that Moses went to Pisgah, and you'll read how Moses went to Nebo. But that's no contradiction, because Nebo is a mountain in the peak. Like, as I have told you before, Clingman's Dome is a mountain in the Smoky Mountains. And so he was taken up on Mount Nebo, and there Moses was allowed, but as I said, he wasn't allowed to enter the land. He was allowed to view the land of Palestine. And those that have been there say that on a clear day, you can stand on Mount Nebo where Moses stood, and you can see from the northern to the southern extremity of the land of Palestine all the way over to the Mediterranean Sea. You can see the Jordan Valley and the Jordan River as it winds itself southward down through that land, and you can see the totality of it. And Moses was given that view. And the Bible says Moses died, and where he was buried, no man knows except God buried him there on that mount somewhere. Now, one of the significant things of the journeys of Israel to the land of Canaan is that it is typical of and is a free picture of the Christian's journey toward heaven. There are just so many parallels that we find. And sometimes we'll have a lesson just on showing the parallelism between the journey of Israel to the promised land and the journey of the Christian to the ultimate spiritual promised land of heaven. But as the book of Numbers closes We find the Israelites now poised on the eastern bank of the Jordan River. And they are near the location of entrance into the promised land. And as I have already said, certain initial victories had already been accomplished, and soon the leadership was changed from Moses into the hands of the very capable and faithful Joshua. And so this land promise that God had given all the way back to Abraham, I'm going to make you a father of a great nation. They're going to be as numberless as the stars of the heavens and the sands of the sea. I'm going to make you bless those that bless you, curse those that curse you. I'm going to give you a land. Give those people a land that would be their own. And of course, and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. We're about to see the accomplishment and the fulfillment of the land promise that God gave to Israel. And that's very significant, because a lot of people today say, well, God is going to give the land of Palestine to that political system that's known as the Israel nation. Why, the Israel nation doesn't touch top, side, nor bottom anything that's in the Bible whatsoever. That's not the same Israel at all. And God has already given the nation that He promised that land. He already gave that land. And Israel is now ready to cross the Jordan River and to take the land that God gave them. But the story of taking that land skips a book. It picks up with the book of Joshua. And in between the book of Numbers is the book of Deuteronomy that has a very, very unique significance about it. And before we will continue this historical, gradual unfolding of the scheme of redemption that culminates in Christ, why, we will pause for a while in our historical study next week, Lord willing, and we will look at the book of Deuteronomy. Keep in mind, folks, when you study the Bible, it is well that you study it in the light of what period is this talking about? Who is this talking about? When were these people involved? How is all of this connected together? And as you get the panoramic overview of all the Bible by looking at each book, you can see how that God has just fitted all of that so perfectly together in a revelation that we today can fully understand and can know God's hand was in it all. And salvation is available because of what God has done through Israel and through the Christ. And that leads us to our invitation, because if we're going to enjoy the spiritual promised land of heaven, dear friend, we're going to have to come to the Christ that God has provided. And we do that by faith, repentance, confession, and baptism. There is no other way to serve God other than through Christ. Not a way that God will accept. And so we are happy to plead with people, persuade people, come to Christ. If you haven't been faithful, you need to be restored through repentance, confession, and prayer. And as we study these things, let our appreciation of God's revelation and our thanksgiving of how He has unfolded all of this on our behalf, and then have the good wisdom to take advantage of what He has done.